Hello and welcome to the Astana International Financial Center's Legal Tech Podcast with your host, Mark Beer. It's a great pleasure to welcome Helen Tung, one of a rare breed of space lawyers, to this podcast. And given Kazakhstan's significant role in global space programs, still launching the vast majority of missiles, rockets and satellites out into space, it's wonderful to be able to talk to one of the foremost thinkers when it comes to space law in the world. So Helen, tell us a little bit, what is space law and how does a space lawyer work?
Hi, Mark. So thank you so much for having me on board, and obviously Astana Financial Center as well. So everyone is familiar with space. You know, when we look up to the sky, the stars, and we see the moon more recently as well, and, you know, space launches, we're all fascinated by space, and I'm no different, except I sort of came into it by accident. As you know, I was called to the bar in London, mainly working in commercial disputes, and the opportunity just rose, is this it? There's a phenomenal question when you, well, usually for people who reach the peak of their careers and start asking questions like these. I needed some time out, so I ended up going to Silicon Valley. I spent 3 months there working and engaging with startups, particularly with an organization called Singularity University. And it opened my eyes, and I sort of like plunged into the deep end and tried to co-found my own satellite propulsion system startup, which, to be honest, like a few years ago, I would have been totally clueless. But I went there, I had a leap of faith, and I ended up, you know, mingling with the likes of astronauts and, you know, getting to know entrepreneurs in the space world, and also attending conferences like the International Aeronautical Congress. I attended UNOSA, which is your equivalent of the United Nations Office of Outer Space. And that was the beginning of my journey of engaging in space startups. And so as a space lawyer, it's no different like any other lawyer, except with an interest and passion, in my view anyway, at least in space. So in a very sort of broad brush approach, you've got lawyers who work in space for governments, which is sort of the very obvious on space law and policy, but I suppose it would surprise you that actually it's more about politics than law, if I can put it like that. In terms of recent developments, it's very, very exciting. So if I start with what's happening in Luxembourg a few years ago, and I sort of was there when the Ministry of Economics announced launching a new law on space minerals and resources. So current space law, or let's say we go back to the Moon Treaty, is that all, you know, space resources are owned, you know, by the whole world. Nobody physically owns it, but what Luxembourg passed was any business that goes up to space, you know, mines an asteroid, takes the resource back to Earth, it's theirs. Okay, so the shift in mindset is totally different, where previously no one owns the moon, as it were, or be it, you can draw a parallel with the high seas, but now an entity, a legal entity that goes up to space can. So you saw that happening, and it rocked the legal world and it rocked the space world. And then slowly what you saw was a whole wad of space startups shifting their operations to Luxembourg. And Luxembourg was very smart because they didn't really engage with the European Commission, in the sense that if you imagine, if they engage all the sort of like countries in Europe about this legislation, it would never have flown because you would have too many, you know, arguments and disputes on what the law should have been. But I thought it was a very brave move, and so I would say Luxembourg is a first, you know, a first contender. And then you've got the US, who's always had an interest in space, not least SpaceX and the likes of, you know, Blue Origin, SpaceX, and all these other companies like Aerospace Corporation, Boeing, and etc. So I think Trump more recently also have made announcements on, you know, commercialization of space in their Space Act as well. So you see a lot of developments. And Kazakhstan has a very special place in, I guess, the history of space because of space launch. And I'm one of those people that have expressed to you would love to visit, particularly, you know, once things, you know, start moving again, you know, with COVID-19, to see it happening. And my more recent stint before coming to UAE was I was basically tasked and funded by the European Commission and the Ministry of Economics and Finance to double the space sector in Japan. And what was fascinating is actually it's got something to do with the law, but very little to do with it, because at the end of the day, it's about business, it's about entrepreneurship. And so for me, and I guess the theme I would also like to touch upon is how everyday ordinary people can, you know, have a stake or engagement in space. And so there it was very simple. I mean, Japan had two main problems. It was, how do we get young people to share their ideas? Because, you know, when you have a crazy idea, people usually just, you know, sort of minimalize, you know, the impact or the significance of the idea. And secondly, how businesses can actually invest in those ideas. So over the course of a year and a bit, I got heavily involved with the space business, as it were, and also in the UAE. So I actually came to the UAE because I got offered a job to reinsure rocket launches and satellites. And so that is that space connection. And thereafter, you know, becoming a member of the, it's called the International Aeronautical Congress, where they have an annual conference. And this year, it was supposed to be held in the UAE, but unfortunately, because of COVID, it's postponed to next year. So the whole idea is I'm one of the ambassadors for the sort of the, they call it the innovation zone. So it is a pretty much like matchmaking of investors and startups, and the interest is in space. So you can see where the law comes in, because obviously there's contracts to be had, you know, be it investments, be it in deliverables. So it's a very exciting time.
That's absolutely fantastic. And I don't even want to think about the insurance of a space rocket. That must be something quite extraordinary, given it is a very large object full of high explosive. But I want to pick you up, if I may, Helen, on a very important point close to my heart, because some years ago, my wife for Christmas bought me a plot of land on the moon. And I got an official title deed and everything. And I'm concerned by your reference there that nobody owns the moon, except for myself, presumably. What's happened there, this commercialization of space? Really, when you say that I could own an asteroid, but I can't own the moon, I saw your TEDx talk about, you know, building a community on the moon as a precursor to building a community on Mars. What are the ownership rights when it comes to these things?
So the question I have for you is, you may, your wife might have bought it from my friend who does exactly that. And that is the spirit, that is the right spirit of doing it. So for example, let's say that certificate that gave you a land title for X space cost 20 quid, okay? You get 20 million of people buying that. Now that is genius, right? I tell you, total genius. The next question is, well, how do I actually actualize that piece of paper, right? It's no different from anything that you buy, you know. And if I start on that basis, you've got to have the right mentality before you then go on to the next stage. So in my TEDx talk, which thank you for bringing it up, it was actually part of a workshop that was developed at the International Space University, which is a bunch of, let's say, a group of engineers, scientists, philosophers, artists, and of course the lawyer, where we came together to brainstorm on this idea, because it can't possibly work just, you know, us lawyers sitting there, you know, in theory how it would work, because we need people to actually come together like a working group to say, well, actually in reality, how would it work? So if we take it in stages, okay, so I my talk was sort of focused in 2060, which is probably when I'm in my 70s, you know, 80s, how would it work? Is let's talk about who's going to go out there first, right? The people that are going to go out there first are not going to be the lawyers, although the lawyers would probably like to go there first. It'll probably be the drillers, the people that are going to wield, you know, the architects, the designers, who are going to look at the landscape and see, you know, how it's going to be done and sort of set the foundation of where things are. Now, the more tech-savvy person would say, well, it's probably not even going to be humans. It's going to be the robots, right? So I know startups, they're doing robotic arms in Japan. You know, there are people who are already developing androids, because scientifically speaking, it's very expensive for an astronaut, for a human being to physically go out there and survive the atmosphere. Okay, so that's the problem for a start. And then the second point is, let's say we get all the technology on board, and let's say we're all fit and healthy. So that's the vision that, you know, SpaceX has, which is, you know, short of, you know, professionally trained, government-selected astronauts, you and I, hopefully in the next, you know, foreseeable 5-10 years, will be, you know, the ideal consumer, as it were, to buy a plane ticket, buy an air flight ticket, and go to space, you know, for a weekend, for a holiday, for a year, you know, for a few weeks, a month, you know, so to, yeah. Now they use the term of colonization of, you know, Moon and Mars, which I don't like the word, but for argument's sake, we're using that word because it's the first batch of humanity to go out there. Now, to your question of land rights, it's a huge question because right now, in accordance with the laws that we have, you know, the space treaty and all that, it can't possibly be the case, but that's on a governmental level. On a individual level, this is where it gets very exciting and where, to be honest, like you talk about UNOSA, and I've sat through a number of their legal committee meetings. The lawyers representing the states are very reluctant to touch this topic because obviously it's controversial. It opens up a can of worms and it opens up probably a very heated discussion if we were to explore a new planet, yes? In the same way, the Newfoundlands, you know, the people that explored, you know, Australia, Captain Cook and whatnot, how would it look like? Now, the conversation gets very interesting because we work on the assumption that there's nobody out there. Okay, we've got the assumption that it's just, you know, this round water, you know, but for all I know, there could be other species out there, right? And when we talk about species, and when you talk to the scientists from SETI, I'm sure you've watched films with Jodie Foster, you know, when we talk about species, it goes all the way down to bacteria, right? Down to bacteria. But then if you get more, you know, sci-fi, well, there could be potentially aliens, right? If we want to go out there. But let's say on the basis that, let's say, you know, it's a piece of land with nothing on it. Let's just start with the basics and then we can make it more complicated. Well, then in that case, you know, would say the theory, at least with my friend, is everyone's got a right. You know, anyone who puts their stake on it would probably have say. But I personally think that can't be the case because then what you're doing is you've got the north-south divide. So you look at the United Nations, this, you know, the haves and the have-nots. So then it would be totally skewered to, you know, the developed countries as opposed to the developing countries. And we can already see that in films. We can already see that currently in the UN, where developing countries are like saying, okay, the developed countries have technology. The developing countries want to have a piece of that technology. And so we've got the notion of technology transfer, where in replacement of, you know, goods and services, we would do a barter exchange. You know, I will give you the manpower. The first batch of people sending out there might be proper drillers and developers, you know, from developing countries, you know, masterminded, as it were, you know, with people from both mixed developed and developing countries. And then there's a question of ownership and sharing of that knowledge. So I do feel there has to be an element, whilst not directed by the governments, but I do feel from the people, there has to be some sort of like-minded view of how we're going to do this sustainably, how we're going to do it. And it's not going to be just about the money. I really feel it's a bit like a beauty contest with a conscience, right? So it's not just, you know, I've got the big bucks and I've got the big, you know, driller and I can do this. No, I feel really we need to, you know, be mindful of the people who are going to be, you know, the first set of leaders, you know, on a very communal level, you know, to go out there and know the stuff, know the landscape of space. And fortunately, and it's a good thing that a lot of people that I've known in the space sector, at least, are very humanitarian and, you know, they are very conscious. Well, they know what's happening. They know, you know, the elements. You know, there are the astrophysicists, you know, are people who actually understand the science of space. And then you've got the investors who, you know, for better or worse, are just investing for, you know, an ROI, return on investment. And then you've got the lawyers who are very curious but probably know very little about the landscape of, you know, what space is all about. But having said that, it's very exciting, you know, for me, because when I went to Japan, I could see, for instance, there's a huge development of, you know, space lawyers. And we're talking innovative, you know, people who are keen to try and understand what the business is all about. Because without knowing the business, we can't deliver on the law or be it even shape the law to help the businesses, you know, evolve.
It does. And I'm just mostly disappointed that my wife only spent £20 on my Christmas present. More seriously, Helen, talk to me about the laws that apply in space. I mean, to be a space lawyer, one assumes that there needs to be some law. If my satellite bangs into your satellite, what law do we apply? How does it work? The Kingdom of Asgardia exists now on a server bank in space. And what laws apply in that jurisdiction?
If I look at Asgardia, it's an amazing concept because it's all about about a governance of the people and a governance of so if I can draw upon and this notion of space, sci-fi and films are going to come in, because if we think of Star Wars, okay, and I haven't watched every single Star Wars film, but there is an order, okay, there's like an order in space, okay, I'm not talking about the good guys, the bad guys and Darth Vader, but in essence, how society is run is very much based on this notion of consensus. Now, between you and me, there are no differences between that notion in terms of space or what potentially could be, let's say in Star Wars, to what's happening in the world now, right? Like, for example, you were formerly, leadership in DIFC courts. It's no difference. It's our own society in itself and how it's going to be governed in terms of leadership and how it's decided. Now, one of the interesting things which the states previously haven't, so when the United Nations Office of Outer Space drafted, the Moon Treaty and all that, one of the key points was nuclear. So nuclear, and it was during the period of the Cold War, right? So, what you call prisoner's dilemma, nobody wanted nuclear up in space because they were thinking of an arms race and they were thinking, what if we end up blowing each other? But the ironic thing is, if you look at the scientific research, if we want to go to space, we need energy. And ironically, nuclear energy is probably the fastest way to get us up to space. Now, I'm not a scientist, so I cannot really advocate for that. But for me, it's interesting because then it begs the question, do we need to update the space laws, which therefore, relying on states is going to be a very sensitive and tough issue. Not even talking about space, talking about Earth, nuclear is already a very big, controversial topic. That's a starter. The second thing is, I think business communities are slowly engaging one another. So right now, for instance, the IAC, International Aeronautical Congress, which is a huge body of space actors, are still a majority space agencies, big space players. But I think what will be interesting in the next 10, 20, 30 years are the startups. Because as a startup, by definition, I would say they're a disruptor. So where, in the past, an engineer, working for NASA or ESA would say, sorry, that's going to take us 20 years, $50 billion to get us up there. A startup would say, it's going to take 5 years and it's going to take, the next few years. So we're looking at the likes of SpaceX. We're looking at the likes of, Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin, who, in essence, in the next, few years, space tourism, i.e. you and I going on a spacecraft, going for a whiz tour of, space, landing there and staying there for a long period of time is a secondary question, but the initial thought is going to be a lot faster. And for the start, we don't need to be astronauts. Now, going back to your question about space satellite, wonderful question. So to give you an idea, you may have heard of this concept called what they call constellations. Okay, so the constellations, which is what Virgin Galactic is doing, which is what a lot of organizations, including OneWeb, before they filed bankruptcy, were considering doing, is connecting the world via internet. So I'm sort of trying to give you a context and then talk about the collision of satellites, okay? So, for example, half the world right now has access to internet. Imagine a world where everyone has internet. That is a thought to be had. When you talk about commerce, when you talk about, equality, access to justice, water, and technology and all that. So when you have this constellation around the world, it's actually related to ITU, the International Telecoms Union. And the way it's been set up, and we're talking about a very old system that was, set in place 30, 40 years ago, is you have a slot, okay? And these slots are bought out by states, and the states decide who has it. So the system, you could say, is a little bit outrun by itself. If you, as a startup or a business, has the privilege of buying a frequency, you can then sublease it to another startup. Now, on a very practical term, when I was working with the space startup on satellite propulsion, so you imagine a satellite, which are huge, right? Now what's happening is they're being developed smaller and smaller and smaller, called small sats. So I'm part of an organization called the Space Alliance, and it's all about helping the small satellite industry to grow. Why? Because it serves a lot of purposes. You have a number of startups, and I'm just going to throw some names out there which might be foreign, but what they do is amazing. There's a startup called Planet. And what they do is they do digital imagery, but quickly, it's not probably, I mean, it's as precise as you can get, but it's not the most precise imagery. So they can look at weather forecasts, they can look at flooding, they've even been able to monitor the movements in during COVID-19, okay? So for example, the medics, the people and all that. So it serves a purpose, a humanitarian purpose on the ground. And if we were to look at the United Nations records, you know, whilst space seems very far away, the application, what we call space applications, is the trillion-dollar business, right? So where you and I use our mobile phones, lo and behold, it's space that connects us all together, yeah? And the phenomenon is nobody knows that. Everyone thinks, oh, it's just my mobile phone, I pay for my Wi-Fi, and that's it. But this is the trillion-dollar business. So when a satellite collides, you can imagine there's a few problems, okay? And it poses very interesting questions for the lawyers, because in a traditional matter, if you and I collide in a car, well, there's video cameras, there's witnesses. When it happens in space, who is the witness? You know, short of an alien coming, you know, and telling us, oh, I saw that happening, it's going to be very difficult. So what ends up happening in space is when two satellites collide, you get insurance, but it is going to be the engineers on the ground making an assessment. That was what my old job was about. And we're talking lots and lots of money, okay? And there's a few problems. Let's say it collides, it causes space debris. Now, when I was advising the UAE, looking through the space legislation, that was one of the biggest things, because in the past, nobody tracked this. In the same way, when people were throwing rubbish in the high seas, no one really thought, we can have a problem called space debris. But now, and when I say now, I do mean in more recent years, people are coming to become aware, wait a second, we can't have a functional space economy, ecosystem. We've got all this rubbish floating about, and if a rubbish piece of, you know, debris knocks over my satellite, that's the end of my, you know, multi-million dollar investment, you know, for whatever purpose this satellite is being used for, telecoms, you know, data imagery, disaster management, etc. So the next question is, who is responsible? Now, between you and me, I would say, well, of course, it's the companies. Whoever sent this thing up ought to be responsible, but it's not so simple. Because if you leave it to the companies, they're going to say, well, it's not my problem. I've done my bit. I was subcontracted to send this thing up. And it's not my problem, particularly at the end. So there's a lot of discussion. There's one startup out there, Astroscale, which I really love, and their mission is all about space debris removal. Can you imagine space rubbish being a business? But it is, because in the same way that you and I have our bins collected, it's not glamorous, it's not sexy, but it's absolutely vital that we have that so that, you know, things don't stink and that, you know, things are sustainable. So they've got that going, and one of their business development guys is actually a former NASA guy, so he knows exactly what he's doing, what he's looking at. So I think what we're going to see is in the next few years is we're going to see this convergence of startups who have the know-how, who have the technology, who has to talk to the businesses, who has to work with the policy guys, the businesses, and the governments to really try and get things moving. Because if you leave it to the policy guys, they don't know what the startups are all about, and then nothing happens, right? And the lawyers are a perfect and an ideal candidate to facilitate that discussion, because they understand the law and policy, they know what the government's trying to do, and if they can get their head around the technology of what does this technology serve, then in the terms and conditions, right, we can kind of think up of something where it could be resolved. Now, let's go back to your pet subject or your favorite subject of arbitration and disputes, right? Because it's not going to be easy. Right now, it's pretty much got a problem, you try and save your butt and I try to save mine. But in the long run, that is not going to be sustainable, because for a small business, let's say a small startup, where money is already tight, if you're going to send a few million dollar business up into space and there's no remedy for them, that is the end of the business. You know, it's like a one-shot business. So the insurers need to come in and actually play an active role, okay, with the support of the government. In the same way, like, I'll give an example. When I was working in autonomous shipping, which is now quite a trendy topic to talk about as well, there was no insurance, right? Lloyd's didn't even blink an eye. It's like, what is this about? But a few years ago, and I was physically there, Lloyd's announced they were going to introduce a new kind of insurance, and it was going to enable traditional ship owners, if they were to produce, you know, smart ships, autonomous ships, they would be insured. Now, that for me makes business sense, right? It's called distribution of risk, right? So I know my business, I know my technology, but I need the lawyers to understand this, and I need the insurance sector, I need to, you know, I need to engage with all these people and the policymakers to understand my business so that we can make it happen. So there's a lot of work to be done, and it's very exciting. And I think, you know, particularly, you know, for those that can dream, and the investors also need to understand, you know, what kind of risks we're facing. But to be fair, when I think of investors, I think of two kinds. I think of the ROI, which I was telling you, which is the majority. And you've got a minority who are the strategic investors, whom I absolutely love. So they are like the likes of Richard Branson. Think big, you know, brainchild of, you know, genius ideas. But you only need one or two of them. So, for example, when I went to Japan, my job was to write a report advising the government on how to double the space sector. And I said, it's not going to work because it's going to be a text that's going to be on a shelf that nobody's going to read. But if I speak to young people, and we only need a few more Elon Musks in this world to create some magic and really get things going. So when I tried to explain these to engineers, you know, from big Japanese companies, they really couldn't understand what I was trying to do. I was basically trying to say to them, it's like a talent show, right? If you can find one or two people with great ideas who is willing as a young child, teenager, entrepreneur who's left university to work on these ideas with the backing of governments and lawyers and, you know, other people to build their idea, then you can really create an ecosystem. So the magic happens not, you know, at the highest level. It happens on the ground with young people and everyone else, you know, like a community supporting them. So I hope that answers your question. So what does a space lawyer do? So I think a space lawyer has a job that's much more than just writing a contract. They really need to understand the business, and they need to be able to be in a position to be a good advisor, like a good lawyer, to advise the business properly on how to make things happen. Because the client's going to be stuck, they're not going to be able to understand things, and you're going to be that cheerleader to help them along the way, including, which is happening with a lot of, not necessarily the lawyers, a bit of lobbying, right? Because when the Space Act in the US passed, it was space lawyers lobbying the government to make it happen.
Earlier on, you mentioned that satellites are transferring large amounts of data. They're providing internet. A lot of what we do on Earth is being moved around in space on satellite, which means there's a lot of data moving around in space. And data is enormously valuable. So what stops me sending up a satellite, and all it does is it captures all of the data moving around in space, which I then exploit from space. I'm not subject to any GDPR or other regulations in space. I exploit all that data through my satellite in space, and I sell it back to countries on Earth. Is that a crime? Am I doing anything wrong? Am I breaching any space regulations on data? And is this going to be our next venture?
Well, to be honest, this is already happening, Mark. It really is. And the answer is no, because there's no laws on it. So on Earth, and in fact in the UAE, you know, there's recently a law being passed and it will be coming into place, which is the data protection laws, which is very stringent, but it's very much in line with what's happening in Europe in terms of the GDPR. In space, it's free reign. And that is why it's a call for lawyers who have their heart in the right place to actually play an active role and say, actually, you know what? This is something I can actually work on and develop, because if you say it's too hard and if you say it's impossible and if every other lawyer thinks the same way, then by gosh, we don't have any laws. So I think you're onto something, and that is, I think, my final, I guess, my call to whoever's listening to this recording, who's interested, who's enthusiastic, you know, and even if you're business minded, you know, money is going to come with it, right? Because someone somewhere is going to develop a technology, who's going to sell this product, and they would need your help. So I would say, you know, it is an amazing opportunity for everyone. And in fact, I'll tell you something funny. When I was in Japan, you know, I was very fortunate. I was invited by so many of my fellow lawyer friends for dinner. And there was a guy who was a family lawyer. And so I was talking to him, and he was fascinated by space. And I turned to him and I said, you know what? You can also be a space lawyer, one of the first family space lawyers, because you imagine, you're going to have families, some of them working in space, some of them working from home. You've got wills. You've got landlord and tenant, and you've got all these areas of law. And he looked at me and he said, Helen, you're right. You're absolutely right. And so he's joined forces with me as a space lawyer. And you know what? It takes a bit of imagination, because we're going to have to imagine what kind of future? And it's no different as a lawyer. When you have a client who comes to you with a problem, what are the scenarios? What are the possibilities? So it's purely allowing yourself to think more creatively and to think about, well, if there's a problem, what is my potential solution? So that's the last thing. So I want to invite everyone. It does not matter what area of law you're in, what expertise you're in, space, there's a piece of it for you. So that's my final message. Thanks, Mark.
Helen Tung, one of the world's leading space lawyers. It's been an absolute pleasure having this conversation with you. We could carry this on for days. I'm delighted that we should all be thinking outside of the box. We should all be thinking outside of the planet. And space is the next frontier, not just for lawyers, but for business too. It's been an absolute delight. And I'd like to thank you very much, Helen, for your time.
This podcast is being produced by the Astana International Financial Centre and moderated by the chairman of the AIFC Law Tech Advisory Council, Mark Beer. Thank you very much for listening. If you would like to hear more information on the Astana International Financial Centre's Law Tech Advisory Council, please follow us on LinkedIn.